there was a presentation I had to give to some donors, and that I thought I'd be able to do it from the hotel room, but the timing didn't work out. So that's why we're doing it today. Thank you, everyone, for being flexible with your schedules. And let's go ahead and jump into tonight's lecture. What we're talking about today is interventionism, and in particular, price controls. So we're going to end up doing price ceilings and price floors, and that's the sort of thing, and the various attributes of them. All right, so this is if you're going to teach somebody about government intervention, this is like a perfect example to start out with, but it's sort of self-congratulatory because that's what I am starting out with, right? That's the way I wrote the textbook, and that's why it's laid out this way. But this is the kind of thing where, you know, the dichotomy between what the average person thinks a government program is going to do and who it's going to help versus what actually happens in practice. I think these just are the epitome of that sort of phenomenon. Okay, let's just do a quick review from the discussion last week about supply and demand, just because that was, it was a lot of material. I had to go through it pretty quickly, and I just want to make sure you understand the basics of that. That this particular example, and also the reason for this is I really cannot stress enough that if you need to understand how these supply and demand curves work. All right, so if you know, a lot of the stuff we do in this course, if you didn't quite get it and you missed some of the questions on the quiz that week, it's that would have been the end of it, right? It's just, if you didn't get it, you didn't get it, okay, and we move on and do something else that's not utterly dependent on that material. Whereas the supply and demand stuff, you're going to see that's going to be using that with the price ceilings and floors in today's class, right? And so if you didn't really get that, then you're not going to really get what we're talking about today. It's just going to be vague generality. So I really would encourage you, if you went through it quickly last week and you didn't quite get it down, but you thought, I don't care, it's just a bunch of graphs anyway, I'm not overloading this textbook with graphs. I put those in there for a reason, because I think with the supply and demand curves or lines, those are for sure worth taking the time to figure out how to use them. That it's the benefits exceed the costs, if you will. Okay, so let's just review that. So this is the oil market example. Let me just walk you through those steps again to see the level of understanding that you would need to be able to follow everything else that we're going to do in this class in terms of supply and demand curves. So the story or the scenario that went along with this example, remember, was saying that OPEC countries announced that they're going to cut back in production. Or if you want to make it more newsworthy, you could say the story could just as well be there's strife in Libya, and because of the physical problem and also because Western nations are putting financial sanctions on Libya. I don't know if you guys know this, but Libya can't export oil right now, partly because there's the physical interruptions, but also because they can't sell it to foreign buyers because banks are afraid to touch transactions denominated in U.S. dollars that go through Libya because there's sanctions in place, right? So, you know, bankers are saying, look, we're not even sure that even if it's coming from rebels who are trying to sell oil to raise money to keep the fight up, you know, we're not going to make that judgment call. We don't want to do something that then the U.S. comes along 2 months later and says we violated their trade sanctions, so we're not touching that stuff. So anyway, it's just interesting that part of why Libya's exports are completely halted right now is not because of just stuff getting blown up. It's because of financial sanctions. But anyway, whatever the reason, suppose that we know that the production or export of oil coming out of the OPEC region is down. Okay, and then we say, okay, what effect is that going to have on the oil market? And when we say effect, what we mean for this course is just, is the price going to go up or down, and is the quantity going to go up or down? That's all we mean. We're just looking for this qualitative, just to get an intuitive sense of which way are things going to move. So how do you answer that? The way you do all these kind of problems in this class is you draw an initial supply and demand curve. All right, and so the supply curve is always upward sloping, and the demand curve is downward sloping. And then they have an initial intersection point. And so in this diagram, I've got a P1 and Q1. And then you have to ask yourself, okay, at least one of the curves is going to move now as a consequence of whatever the story is that we're telling. So in this case, which one is it going to be? You say, well, is the demand for oil going to change just because there's fewer barrels? Hang on, let me adjust the camera there. Just because there are fewer barrels of oil being exported from the OPEC nations. And we say, okay, well, what is the demand for oil? Well, that's just showing the relationship between various hypothetical prices of oil and how many barrels of oil that consumers want to buy. And in this case, the consumer would be like oil refineries, right? They're the people that actually go out and buy physical crude oil, take delivery of it, because that's an important component in their business, because they take that and they turn it into gasoline or jet fuel or whatever. So oil refiners are a major purchaser of crude oil, and so you have to say the mere fact that fewer barrels are getting exported from OPEC, is that going to affect the demand for oil? And the answer is no. And again, remember, we're not saying that the fact is irrelevant to the buyers of oil. What we're saying, though, is that it's the only reason they're going to care about that information is because they're going to say, oh, that's going to make the price go up. Okay, but it's not that it changes their willingness to buy a certain number of barrels at a given price. Okay, so let me just say that in different words. I want to make sure you understand that. When we're talking about, you know, would a certain effect or would a certain thing, scenario, is that going to impact the supply or the demand side? That's not the same thing as saying, is it going to matter to people that are producers or consumers? Okay, that for sure, people, oil refineries, they might slap their heads like, oh, no, this is terrible if they hear about the situation in Libya or if the OPEC nation just announced we're going to cut back production by 10%. Okay, or if you know, if you're someone driving your car for a living, you might say, oh, that's terrible. Okay, but my point is, it doesn't change your demand for oil or for gasoline to hear that news. The reason you think it's terrible is because you know that's going to mean the equilibrium price is going to end up being higher, and so you're going to have to pay more for your oil. All right, so but it's the point, it's not changing your willingness to buy a certain quantity of oil at various hypothetical prices. Okay, so the demand curve is not going to move because of that announcement, but the supply curve is going to move. Right, that's what we're saying. At various hypothetical prices now, they're going to export less oil. And so what that means is we're drawing a new supply curve that's to the left of the original one. So there, I don't know if it's how much we need to go into that, but just so you're not getting confused, if it's screwing you up to think, what do you mean we're moving the supply curve? I don't understand what that even means. Well, then don't use that language. Just say we're drawing a new supply curve that's to the left of the original one. Because that's really what's happening. It's not that we're picking up a line and we're walking 10 feet to the left and dropping it. All right, we're just saying we're drawing a new set of points corresponding to the new supply schedule. And just if you look at the picture, it kind of looks like the curve shifted to the left. That's all we mean. All right. So, and just let's make sure you see why it goes to the left. Because now, at any hypothetical price that you pick, so any line, any little notch of P on this left axis, this one that goes up and down, the y-axis, if you then file that out to the right in a straight line, you're going to hit that new supply curve, the S2, before you would hit the original supply curve, S1. And so what that means is, at any hypothetical price, supply is now lower, right? Because the quantity supplied is smaller. It's not as wide. Because remember, the further out you go to the right on this diagram, that means you're going out farther on the x-axis. Okay, so that's, again, this is probably simple for most of you, but in case there are some of you that aren't very comfortable with graphing lines and things, I just want to make sure you get why shifting the supply curve to the left is the same thing as saying there's a restriction in supply. Because we're saying at any hypothetical price on this new S2 curve, or line, the producers are selling fewer barrels of oil. So if oil is $80 a barrel, Now they're only selling, whatever, 10 million barrels a day, whereas before they might have sold 12 million. All right? And then if oil is $200 a barrel, now they're selling, whatever, 20 million, but before they would have sold 25 million. So the point is, for any hypothetical price, they're selling fewer barrels now than they would have at that same price before the change. And that's the way that appears graphically, is a supply curve that's to the left or above the original one. Okay, so that's the way the curve would move, right? The D stays the same, the supply shifts left. And then to say, so what effect does that have on price and quantity? It's just a simple matter of seeing, okay, where does the intersection now lie? So if you had the original intersection with the P1 and Q1, now you move that S2, and so it hits the D curve sort of, you know, northwest. And so what does that mean? Well, it's the P is higher, right? If you at that new intersection point, you draw a dotted line back out to the y-axis and see what P does it now intersect with, that's going to be higher than the original P. So that's why we're saying the new P2 is a higher price than the original P1. And then by the same token, this new intersection point, if you drop it down to see where does it intersect the x-axis and call that Q2, well, that's closer to the origin, right, the 0, 0 point, than the original Q was. And so that's why we're saying quantity is lower also. Okay, so in general, that's true, that for a generic market, whether it's the oil market or the apple market or the milk market, whatever, if supply shifts left while demand stays the same, then the result is prices go up and quantity goes down. All right, so this, going back to the consumer side now, what's happening is we're saying, look, there's fewer barrels of oil coming on the market. And since the demand itself is the same, what needs to happen to restore equilibrium is the price has to go up, okay, because consumers haven't changed their taste for oil, right? Oil refiners are just as happy buying the same quantity at the same price as they were before, but we know there's less quantity, right? There's fewer barrels of physical oil coming on the market now because the OPEC producers cut back production. So what has to happen? Well, the market price goes up. And so we move along the demand curve. So let me just say that again in other words. The supply curve itself shifted. The demand curve didn't shift, but we moved along the demand curve because of the higher price. Okay, and so that's why quantity demanded and quantity supplied are still equal in the new equilibrium. The difference, though, is at the higher price. Okay, so that's how we reconcile those two things. And so the consumers, their demand for oil didn't change, because remember, demand is that whole relationship. But it is true that at the higher price, they're demanding fewer barrels of oil. The quantity demanded did go down. But we wouldn't want to say their demand went down, because then that makes you think that the whole curve moved, and that didn't happen. Okay, so why don't we, with that background, now let's go ahead and move along. Okay, so interventionism. We're going to first talk about price ceilings and use a specific example of rent control. Let me back up and talk a little bit more about interventionism, because what I'm doing here is introducing the whole new concept, the whole new section of the textbook. So why don't I spend a minute just giving you the bird's eye view of what we're doing. So we have already in this course, we talked about the fundamentals, the basics of economic principles, in the sense of how do we study economics, what's the scope of economics, what method do we use, talked a little bit about Robinson Crusoe, and then there's a big section on the market economy, and we're talking about private property and people exchanging with each other and how prices are formed and entrepreneurship and all that stuff. And we just went through, and we skipped a couple chapters, but that section is just showing you, hypothetically, suppose you had a society that was completely voluntary in the sense that everybody respected property rights, and so if anyone wanted to use property to do something, that person had to get the consent of the owners. Right, they would either, you know, donate it as charity, or if it's a kid who wants to drive the family car, then the mom or dad says, okay, go ahead and gives them the key, whatever. Or you go and buy it from the person, and they transfer ownership to you in exchange for money. But the point is, that's what we studied, and we looked at how our prices formed and so forth, and how is equilibrium established using supply and demand curves is the way we analyzed it. So that's, we were studying the pure market economy, and we weren't worried about how is it that we protect those property rights. All right, we weren't going to deal with that because that's a very complicated issue, and that would take us really far afield. Okay, so we were just taking it for granted that people respect property rights, and we just spun out the implications of that. And so that's what we were calling up the study of a pure market economy. So now in this topic, this section, we're going to look at interventionism, the mixed economy. All right, so we're skipping the whole section on the command economy. And somebody asked last, I don't know if it was during the office hours or during the lecture itself, but somebody asked, should you guys be reading the chapters that we skipped? And I said, you know, you don't need to in the sense of being tested on it, and it's not that the stuff we're going to do is dependent on it, but certainly I would encourage you to at least skim those chapters on socialism, right, the ones on the command economy, that I think the points in there are pretty important, and just the basic statistics about how many people die in various communist regimes, I think if you haven't seen that before, it's pretty shocking, and it's not something that you would probably learn in a standard education. You know, everybody learns about how many people died in Nazi Germany. Not very many people learn how many people died in Stalinist Russia. And so I think it's just good to see that and to realize the power that a communist government has, and if it decides to use that for nefarious ends, it can certainly cause a lot of damage. Okay, but we don't have time to cover that in this course, so now we're jumping into the section on interventionism. And what that refers to is a system where you have a nominal arrangement of private property, right? So people would refer to these economies as capitalist or as market economies, and they would say, yep, there's private property, there's private ownership here, but the government intervenes. Right, so the government doesn't want to just let the pure laissez-faire outcome occur. It doesn't want to just let pure market forces determine what happens. For various reasons, the government says, you know, we're not going to tolerate this particular outcome, so we're going to come in and fiddle with things. We don't want to have outright central planning. We want to have pure socialism because we know that doesn't work also, but we want to not have pure capitalism either, right? So the way most people would describe it is they would say we're trying to have the best of both worlds, that we all know pure central planning, pure socialism doesn't work, but there are a lot of excesses, they would say, under pure capitalism, or there's a lot of inequality. You don't want to, you know, consumers might be at the mercy of business people selling defective products, or you'd have people starving in the street and that kind of stuff. And so they say we need the government to come in and just tame the excesses of a pure capitalist system. So retaining the engine of growth and prosperity that we know is associated with capitalism, but at the same time, you know, ensuring certain social outcomes or objectives, right? So that's the standard view as to why you don't want either extreme, okay? So obviously, just to lay my cards on the table, I'm going to be very critical of that approach, right? So I just don't want to mislead you. And so what we're going to do for the rest of the course is just go through and show the problems with various types of intervention by the government, and just show that, you know, using the tools of economic analysis, we can look at what are the likely effects of government intervention in these various categories, and then we'll see that if what you're trying to achieve is the official pronouncements of the politicians who are championing these programs, then they're counterproductive. In other words, these programs that have these certain publicly stated objectives are not going to achieve those objectives, right? So that's the way we're going to be analyzing this stuff. But let me be clear. We're not, strictly speaking, it's not that economics is going to say price controls are bad. Right? So economics is a positive science, not a normative one, meaning we don't, economics per se doesn't spit out value judgments. All right, so what we're going to see, economics can say that minimum wage laws will lead to high rates of unemployment among low-skilled people. But that, you know, that's a positive statement. That's just a statement of fact. All right, it's not saying whether that's a good thing or a bad thing. It's just saying this is a fact of the world. This is the way human societies work. If you have a market economy and you put in a minimum wage, this is going to be the outcome. But that's all economics can say. It can't say, and therefore, you shouldn't have a minimum wage law. All right, so it's now as a citizen or as a legislator, you can have your own judgments as to what's good or bad. And so if you think, well, I want to help poor people, I want to lower unemployment, then you might say, okay, therefore, coupled with my knowledge of economic science, I conclude that a minimum wage is a bad idea, or we shouldn't pass that legislation. Okay, but my point is, economics per se doesn't tell us what legislation there should be or should not be, because economics is just showing us a way of interpreting the world and trying to help us understand the implications of our policies better. Okay? It's just, for an analogy, strictly speaking, you know, medical science is neutral on the question of should we preserve human life or try to favor a deadly virus. That, you know, you could have a war going on, and medical doctors on one side could be trying to develop a virus to kill people living on the other, and, you know, on the other side, and on the other side, their doctors could be trying to come up with cures or with ways to vaccinate their people so that they won't get killed by the virus. Okay, and both of the doctors would be using the same body of medical knowledge. Okay, it's not that one side's doctors would be bad doctors, and the other side would be good doctors. They would all be trained, you know, at the best medical schools and what have you, and they might use the same textbooks. It's just their objectives would be different, their value system would be different, their goals would be different. Okay, so that's what I'm trying to say, that with economics, it's the same thing. I mean, if you, let me put it to you this way, suppose for some reason your goal was to foment chaos. You wanted there to be high unemployment, and you wanted, like, I don't know, maybe because you were a politician and you were in the minority party, and you wanted there to be an awful economy when the next election happened so that your guys would all win and the people in the majority would get voted out of office. Well, then you could use your knowledge of economics to try to push legislation that would screw up the economy. Okay, and the point is, you, in order to do that, though, you would still need to know sound economics in order to know what you were doing. All right, to be able to effectively mess up the economy, you'd have to know, how does the economy work? What things could I do to mess it up? And so that's what economics gives you. It shows you how the economy works. Just like medicine can tell you how the human body works and how viruses work, and then, you know, you do with that knowledge what you want, but economics per se doesn't tell you what you should or should not do. Now, having said all that, I mean, the point of teaching the general public economics is because the only reason politicians can get away with implementing bad policies that aren't going to give the predicted results is that the public is ignorant. Okay, so even if you were a politician drawing that scenario that wanted to cause a horrible economy to discredit the people in power, you couldn't just get up there and say, yes, everyone, we passed this measure today because we want to, you know, cause unemployment to go up. Because then they wouldn't get in power, right? People would be mad at them. So the only way this works is if the public is ignorant, and people can get up and say, yeah, we passed a strong minimum wage law so that working families can put food on the table and they can earn enough to live on, and that's just really, you know, a decent society has to have a high minimum wage, right? That's just the mark of a civilized society, and so that's why we pushed this through today and we signed this legislation. that's the kind of stuff they say. So if the general public knows basic economics, they can say, wait a second, that doesn't make sense, because we share values similar to ours, and that if they just had this, a lot better legislation coming out. But again, strictly speaking, economics per se doesn't tell us whether something's good or bad. Okay, so we're going to go over price ceilings and price floors. So the first one we're going to look at right now is a price ceiling. So what this type of intervention is, the government comes in and doesn't like how high the market price would be, right? So the market supply and demand curve, where they would intersect, for some reason the politicians say that price is too high, it's unconscionable, it's unaffordable, and so we're going to pass a law saying it's illegal to charge the price that high. Instead, we're going to set a maximum price, a ceiling. So the ceiling meaning, you know, once you start going up and you hit the ceiling, you stop. That's the idea. So it's a cap, a maximum. Excuse me. So they're going to have price ceilings on lots of stuff, but just for something particular, a concrete example, we'll study rent control. Okay, so again, price ceilings is a broad category. Anytime the government puts a maximum price on something, but for our analysis right now, to make it concrete so I can give you specific illustrations, we'll just talk about a specific example of a price ceiling, which is rent control. So in rent control, what happens is the government says, and this usually happens like in big cities, the government says, for various types of rental units, perhaps in these neighborhoods or these districts and so forth, the maximum you can charge is whatever, $500 per month. And then they might make all sorts of exemptions and caveats to make it a little bit more reasonable, more flexibility. But the point is, if you're a landlord and they catch you okay, I think there was a video freeze, but it looks like we're back. Let's just walk through some of the consequences of a price ceiling, in particular a rent control law. Okay, so with this particular example here, the way you approach this, if we're trying to say how would you graphically demonstrate a rent control law, so I just drew a supply and a demand curve, and there's the original intersection. I just made up some numbers here just to give you a concrete thing to look at. So I said, imagine the original intersection was $800 a month. So the pure market forces, if the government didn't get involved in the apartment market, there would be the supply and demand would intersect at $800 a month, and then if you drop down from the intersection, you see that it intersects the quantity at 10,000. So the idea here is that in this particular area that we're looking at, there would be 10,000 apartment units that would be rented out to various tenants, and the going market price for those would be $800. All right, so now the government says, no, that's too expensive. There's lots of struggling single moms and whatever. People in this neighborhood are kind of poor. That's too high. That's giving too much to the landlords. The landlords don't need to be that greedy. We're going to pass a law saying you can only charge $650 a month. All right, so now what is the, how do you show that graphically? How do you analyze that? You say, okay, so you write 650 below the 800, obviously, because it's a lower price, and then you draw the dashed line over to the right, and that's hitting the supply curve now earlier, and so you drop down, so that number's got to be less than 10,000. So I just said suppose it's 9,000, and then you go back up to that intersection point, and you just keep going to the right until you hit Okay, we back. Sorry, I don't know why my video keeps going off. Okay, so with these particular numbers, what's happening here is there is a shortage of apartments. And if any of you have lived in a big city that has rent control, you know that this is the case, right? If you're trying to get, and I lived in New York for a while when I went to grad school there, and believe me, it is a pain to get an apartment, at least in certain neighborhoods. Right? It's not like just going in and buying something expensive at Best Buy, right? You can get it that day. Or even if you want to buy a car, which is a very big ticket item, very expensive, it's not that hard to do. Okay, but if you're trying to get an apartment, it can be a very long process, and it is very frustrating, and you have to hire, you know, a broker to help you through it and everything, and it's very complicated, and that's because of rent control. It's not because of the nature of apartments. Okay, so why does the shortage happen? Well, it almost by definition it has to happen, because if the demand curve is downward sloping and the supply curve is upward sloping, then what does that mean? That the intersection point, the original market price of $800, that just balanced the quantity supplied and demanded. And so now if the government's saying that's illegal, that's too high of a price, you can only charge $650, well then necessarily that means the quantity supplied is going to be lower than the quantity demanded. All right. Now, we don't know that it's going to be a 3,000 gap. I mean, I just made those numbers up. But the point is, all you have to assume is the demand curve is downward sloping and the supply curve is upward sloping. And if you grant me that, well, then a government price ceiling below the original market price is necessarily going to lead to a shortage. A shortage meaning people are trying to buy more units than the producers want to sell. So remember, in a normal market, this could happen. You can have a shortage in a normal market, but the point is, it gets quickly eliminated because the producers realize, whoa, there's extra people who want to buy our stuff, and we don't have enough to give to them, and so they raise their prices. And then that finally, you know, they keep doing that until the two sides are balanced. But that can't happen here because there's a law against it. So the landlords, even though there's 3,000 people scrambling around town, calling up various landlords saying, do you have any vacancies? And they say, nope, sorry, we're all rented out. So these landlords know full well that $650 is too low of a price. They're saying, we're turning away people who would be willing to pay me more than $650, and I can't give them an apartment. So the landlords would love to raise the price, but they can't because they're afraid if they do, they'll get caught and they'll get fined by the government. So that's why they keep the price at $650. Okay, so already we can see a problem that it's true. Someone might say, well, this is a great thing. It's hurting the landlords. I mean, clearly the landlords are hurt by this policy, right? Because now they're getting $650 a month for their rental units when before they were getting $800. So obviously all the landlords don't like this policy and they're hurt by it. But defenders, proponents of the policy might come back and say, okay, yeah, sure, but the landlords are rich. Who cares about them? The poor tenants are better off. And so all we're doing is, you know, taking money that would have flowed to the landlords and we're redirecting it into the pockets of the tenants. And so, you know, it's a zero-sum game. The tenants are better and the landlords are worse off. Who cares? But that's not quite right. It's true. There are 9,000 people who are still in apartments and are now only paying $650 a month when before they were paying $800. So those 9,000 people, where I'm getting the 9,000 is because it's $650, that's how many apartment units the landlords want to rent out. Okay, and so only 9,000 people now, or 9,000 households, are in apartment units. And so it's true, those people, if you ask them and say, do you like the rent control law, they might say, oh yeah, this is great, I only pay $650 a month before I paid $800. So they might like it, but hang on for a second because we're going to talk about other stuff in a minute, but they might support it. But people who clearly are not better off are the 1,000 that now can't find an apartment. Okay, so where I'm getting that number from is originally there were 10,000 people renting apartments at $800 a month. Now there are only 9,000 people renting apartments at $650 a month. So that gap of 1,000 are people who originally would have had an apartment paying $800, it's true, and now they're certainly not helped by the fact that rents are down to $650 because now they don't have an apartment. Okay, so yeah, it would be great. They would love the fact that it's cheaper rent if they were in an apartment, but they're not. They're, you know, living with their parents or something, or they're doubled up with their buddy because they can't get an apartment of their own. So the fact that apartments are cheaper does not, you know, even at step one of the argument, it's not clear that you've helped all of the renters on net. You arguably helped 9,000 of them, but you definitely hurt 1,000 of them with these particular numbers that I picked. Okay? Let me just mention two more things before we move on. You might be saying, Dr. Murphy, why are you saying only 1,000 people are out of an apartment when the shortage is actually 3,000, according to this diagram? And that's true, but it's a subtle point, but let me just walk you through this. So it's true, at $650 a month, 12,000 people are trying to rent apartments, and only 9,000 can find a landlord who's willing to, you know, be the other side of that transaction. So that means 3,000 people are frustrated, walking around, can't find apartments. But it wouldn't be correct to say those 3,000 would all have apartments if we got rid of the rent control. Because if we got rid of the rent control and the price went from $650 back up to $800, 1,000 of those 3,000 people who are frustrated would end up getting apartments and paying $800 a month for them. But 2,000 of them would just drop out of the market altogether. Right, because remember, at the price of $800, the quantity demanded of apartments drops from 12,000 down to 10,000. Okay, so let me just say that in different words. At the low price of $650, there's a shortage of 3,000 units. What happens? How does that shortage get eliminated when the government, if it were to lift the price control and prices go back up to $800, what happens? The way the market gets rid of that 3,000 gap of 3,000 people who wanted an apartment and couldn't get it, 1,000 of them get apartments, right? It's because at the higher price, we move along the supply curve, and so now landlords are renting out 1,000 more apartments. Instead of renting out 9,000, now they're renting out 10,000. Okay, so that's how we took care of one-third of the problem, is there's now more apartments that landlords are renting out. So that's one part of it. But then the other 2,000, the way we solve that, the way the market deals with that is at a price of $800, they don't want to rent an apartment, right? So they're content to live with their buddy or to move back home because they're saying at a price of $800, you know, I don't want to rent my own apartment. I'll live with somebody else. Okay, so that's kind of a subtle point, but it's important that you understand how that works. Okay, so that's why when I'm trying to analyze the impact of the rent control law on the renters, the tenants, I'm only saying 1,000 of them have been, in a sense, kicked out of their apartments by the government. Because 2,000 of those 3,000, no matter what we did, aren't going to be living in an apartment. So it's true. I mean, those people, in a sense, are hurt by the rent control law because they're being teased, if you will, that at the price of $650, they want to rent an apartment and they just can't get one. So that's probably more frustrating than if the price is $800 and they could get one if they wanted to, they just don't want to because it's too expensive. Okay, but the point is either way, 2,000 of those people aren't going to be in an apartment. So you don't want to say that the fact that they're not in an apartment is due to rent control. That's not quite accurate. But 1,000 of the people would be in an apartment at the price of $800. And so they definitely can, you know, if they understood what was going on, could blame the government law for why they can't find an apartment. Okay, one other point before we move on here. You might be wondering, you know, what the time frame is for this analysis. And this is an instant, well, instant, this is a very short-term analysis, okay? Specifically, we're not dealing here with whether with more apartment units being built or not. So when I say at a price of 650, the quantity supplied of apartment units drops from 10,000 to 9,000, I don't mean that there are fewer buildings being built. Okay, that's not what I'm talking about. I mean, right now, they passed the law, and as soon as the contracts run out and the landlords, you know, can kick their existing tenants out and whatever, they're going to cut back. They're going to keep vacant 1,000 of their units. All right, and that may surprise you, because you might be thinking of just, well, there's a building, an apartment building there. If it's got a certain amount of units, that's the end of the story. They're going to rent it all out or not. But that might be true for a particular building. Remember, that was a story we told about that last week with the last example we went over with the supply curve that looked like a funky shape that went, so I guess from your point of view, it went up and then this way and then this way. I can't tell if I'm doing the mirror image or not with the camera. So for a particular apartment unit, that might be true, that above a certain threshold, the landlord is going to rent out all the units. But for the market as a whole, that's not going to be true. For the market as a whole, we're going to assume it's a nice smooth line showing that for every increment in prices, we get more and more units brought on the market. So let me just spend a few minutes talking about that. The reason we say that is, for one thing, if different building owners have different thresholds for when they go all in and rent out all their apartments or not, if you think about that, if those thresholds are scattered, you know, up and down for various prices, well, then when you lump them all in together, you know, if you had a population of thousands of those landlords, then you might start to get something that looks like a smooth curve, okay? And then, but the other factor is, there are some people that they might keep some of their units spare just because it's like for storage. Okay, so you can imagine a landlord that owns a building and he has 1,000 or not say has 50 units, and maybe at a certain price range he'll rent out some of them, but not all of them, because he keeps some of his, you know, spare stuff that he doesn't want to keep at his house, right? Instead of renting a storage unit, he keeps some of it in these spare rooms and doesn't rent them out because it's cheaper on the margin to do that. But then once the market rate for the apartments goes up, at some point he says, well, that's crazy. I'll rent those out to tenants and I'll go buy storage somewhere else for my stuff, okay? Or maybe he'll keep it vacant in case he has out-of-town visitors come in. You know, like he's got friends that live in Europe or something, and every summer they come and spend 3 weeks in the city. Let's say that it's a landlord who owns a building in New York City. And you can imagine, you know, at a certain price, he's going to rent out most of his units, but he'll keep one available for his out-of-town friends. And maybe he's got several friends like that, and they pop in at different times of the year, and he just, you know, is a favorite to them, gives them this place to live in for a few weeks while they're visiting him in New York. Okay, so it would be too expensive for him to do that if the apartment prices were like $1,200 a month. That wouldn't be worth it to him to do that. But if apartment prices are only $650 a month, then maybe he'll do that. So the idea is, in the whole city, with all the landlords making decisions like that, you can see that even if the physical buildings don't change, I mean, and certainly the physical structures aren't going to change overnight, that when the rent control law gets passed, the quantity supplied of rental units drops right away. Okay, so that's, I just want to make sure you get that here, the supply curve of apartment units is not a physical thing. We're not saying how many bedrooms and bath units physically exist in this geographical region, and that's just that number. No, that's not the case, because what matters for the market for apartments is how many of those are on the market available for tenants to move into, And the point is, if the price is really low, then some of those physically existing vacant rooms aren't going to have human beings living in them, because the owners are going to decide they're going to do something else with them rather than rent them out to tenants. Okay, another effect of rent control is that it lowers the long-run supply. All right, so this is a little bit tricky. It's a subtle point, and it has to do with what I just talked about to extend that. Okay, so let's just back up one second here. In the short run, immediately, when you impose rent control, there's a shortage because the quantity of supply drops. Okay, but notice I haven't moved the supply curve. I'm saying the reason the shortage happens immediately in the short run is because at the lower price, we move along the original supply curve and we move along the original demand curve, and now there's that gap between the two. Okay, but now going to the next slide here, I'm saying there's an additional effect. In the long run, the supply curve itself shifts to the left. If those price controls are in place and people expect them to stay in place, now the supply curve itself shifts, because here, you know, investors who before were considering building a new apartment unit or a new apartment building that was going to have 50 units in it, now they might build a movie theater instead. Because of the rent control law, they realize, gee, before we thought we were going to rent out those units at $800, and now we can only charge $650, so we're running the numbers, and it's better for us to have a movie theater on this property as opposed to having a building with apartment units. Okay, or, you know, people who were going to do renovations to maintain a particular building so that it could continue to be used for tenants, they might run the numbers now and say, yeah, it's, we'll still let tenants keep living in here for now, but we're not going to pump more money into this thing. You know, once it winds down and once, you know, it gets to the point where the furnace breaks or, you know, it needs a new water heater or something like, you know, some major repair, at that point we're just going to sell the property and do, you know, and get out of the business. That we're not going to pump in a bunch more money to keep it going, because at these lower prices, our margins are too squeezed. Okay, and so then that apartment unit shuts down, and all those people have to go find somewhere else to live. Okay, so for various reasons like that, I'm saying the supply curve itself shifts to the left in the long run. And so then, you know, it's sort of like a double whammy. So at the lower rent control price now, that gap between the demand and the supply is even bigger. Okay, but again, I just want to stress, this is a different point from the first one I made. The first one we're saying, even, you know, take all the physical availability as a constant, still you're going to have fewer apartments offered. But this new point is saying even the physical structures, the amount of physical rooms available in the city over time will be lower than it otherwise would have been because of the rent control. So that just more, you know, exacerbates the problem. Okay, since we started late here, I'm going to have to start really speeding up here to get through the material. But the another major problem is what's called non-price rationing. So again, we're just going through here problems of rent control laws, various unintended consequences, things that happen that hurt the very people we're supposedly helping with this legislation. So with non-price rationing, what's going on is you have to realize the market price served a function. It rationed the available supply to the people who wanted it. Okay, that's, you know, you should get in the habit of thinking that that's one of the things that market prices do, right? There's only so much stuff to go around, and people have unlimited desires and possible uses for the limited property that we have. And so what market prices do is they help ensure that the scarce, limited things we have go to the people who want them the most. And it's true, if you have a lot of money, then you get to express your preferences more than somebody who has a little bit of money. That's true. But even people who have a little bit of money with free markets, they can spend their money on the things that they really want. Okay, and so the high price sort of rations that to make sure that there's something there available for the people who really need it. Just to, if you'll permit me to go on a little tangent here, just to give you an illustration of what I mean. So I got called for a training seminar that I have to go to next week, and I just learned about it yesterday, right? Or maybe it was 2 days ago. And so I had to buy tickets. So normally when you're buying plane tickets somewhere, you do it well in advance. But here I was buying tickets for like 8 days after when I was paying for them, and I ended up having to pay like $1,000, okay, just for this dinky little flight. And that was a lot of money, but the point is I really needed, there was no, my alternative would be to rent a car and drive 12 hours both ways. So, and plus I'm not paying for that, I'm getting reimbursed for the ticket. But the point is the company paying for the flight for me would rather have me there than not there, and they'd be willing to pay $1,000 for that, right? And so it's good that the airline had a few seats available at that, price that strikes us as ridiculous, because that's what kept it available, right? If the price had only been $400, then somebody else might have already bought that ticket, and then that flight would be totally full, and I wouldn't be able to get to this place that I just learned about, that I need to be, 8 days later. Okay, so the high price rations it, because the airlines know occasionally there are business travelers that come in and need a last-minute seat to go somewhere, and we've seen that they are willing to pay us $1,000. So sometimes it doesn't happen, from the airline's point of view. Sometimes there's empty seats, but then that's fine. They got people who are flying standby, and they give it to them and so forth. But the point is, when the airline's setting their prices, they know occasionally it's going to hit, and someone's going to come along and actually pay full fare for that, what strikes us as a ridiculously overpriced seat, but really it's not overpriced. Because once in a while, if you really need to get somewhere, or let's say, one of your relatives dies and you have to get out to the funeral the next day, and it pains you, but you got to pay $1,200 for a ticket, but still you pay it because you'd rather pay that and make the funeral than to miss the funeral. And so the point is, if the airlines weren't allowed to charge such a ridiculous price, then they might sell out a lot earlier, and then people who needed to make last minute arrangements, they would have nothing there for them. Okay, so that's the point, that the market prices help ration the available supply to the people who want it the most. And by want the most, we mean are willing to spend money on it. So what's going to happen then if the market price is not allowed to function, if the government comes in and suppresses the market price? Well, that same issue is still there. There are still more people who want the stuff than there is stuff to go around. So there has to be some mechanism or some rule to determine who gets what. But now the point is, we're not going to use prices to do it anymore. We're going to use something else. So in the context of apartment units, think about it. You're a landlord. Okay, think of it from the landlord's perspective. And you've got a building, and you've got, 50 units that you're renting out. And before, you were relying primarily on price. Somebody came up and could pay you $800 a month, and as long as you thought they could actually make the payments, you're like, okay, that's fine. And you could rent out your building, and there wasn't like a long line of people waiting to get in your building. Because at $800 a month, you had enough people who wanted to get in there that you could rent it out, but that was, if somebody left, you would advertise the opening maybe, and then eventually you'd get somebody in there, and $800 was the price that, that maximized your profits, all things considered. But now the government comes along and says you can only charge $650. So now there's a long line of people trying to get into your building, right? You're turning people away. And that goes hand in hand with the shortage. That's what it means when there's a shortage. There's people trying to rent at the going rate that are getting turned away by the landlords. So now that you're a landlord, you can be pickier. Now, for your 50 units, let's say you've got a list of 75 people that want to get in there. Whereas before, for your 50 units, you really only had 50 people who wanted to get in there who were willing to pay $800 each. And now, it's $650 a month. You've got 75 people who are trying to get in who want to rent from you. So now the question is, what are you going to do to pick those 50 out of the 75? Before, you just would have said, okay, well, I'm going to raise the price. So, you know, which of you really wants to live here? I'm just going to keep raising the price until some of you drop away. But now the government's saying you can't do that. That's illegal. So what does the landlord do? Well, the landlord's not just going to flip a coin. He's going to use other methods. And so, for example, if the landlord is a white guy who goes to church, he might be more likely to rent to people that come from his ethnic background or who go to his church. Okay? If some immigrant shows up who doesn't speak English very well, and you know, and it has dark skin or whatever, then the landlord compared to somebody else who looks like him and goes to his church wherever and speaks English and has been living here for his whole life, the landlord's more likely to rent to that guy. Okay, not because he like is a closet racist or anything, but just because he might feel more comfortable because he kind of, you know, he knows what to expect from that tenant, whereas this other guy, he doesn't know very well. He doesn't know, is this guy going to have who's hooligan friends over, or, you know, is he going to stay up late, or I don't know what this guy's all about, whereas I know if I go with this guy, things will probably be fine. Okay, so that is the kind of thing. So if you think about it like that, perversely, the rent control law is shutting out the very people, you know, the disenfranchised or the powerless or so forth, that the advocates of rent control laws think they're helping. And so that, and what people say, and I'm not making this up, if you go to like New York City, when I moved there and I got a thing for NYU students is to, you know, how do you get in the city and what do? And there were tips on renting an apartment. And one of the tips was for how do I get an apartment in a good neighborhood? One of the tips was start going to church. And it wasn't because they wanted you to start praying and maybe there'd be a miracle and you'd get an apartment. No, they wanted you to go to church so you could start meeting people. Because the point was you needed to know somebody to get into an apartment. Let me give you one quick example of that. So when I lived in New York, my old college, there was a guy who had been living with me that I was friends from college with, and you know, he came to New York when I was there too in grad school, and then he left, you know, moved out from where I was and went and got in a new place, because the new place, what happened is my buddy's cousin had been living in this rent-controlled apartment that was in a great location in town. Okay, it was a real, you know, a neighborhood that was where all the clubs were and the cool bars and all that kind of stuff. It was like a real hip area. So it was a great place where young people wanted to live, and the rent that this guy paid was ridiculously low, right? So it was a fantastic location to be able to live in that neighborhood at that price was a real steal, because it was a rent-controlled apartment, and this guy's cousin just happened to be there. But the cousin was getting married, and this wasn't a place where you could have a wife with you. I mean, the apartment was not suitable. it was definitely a bachelor pad. So the cousin didn't want to just give up this fantastic apartment. He wanted to give a favor to somebody. And so you know, he asked around to see who wants it. And so then, it turned out that he said, oh, you're my cousin. Hey, do you want to come take this place over? And so that, you know, my buddy went and did that. And so, you know, to ask, well, how did my buddy end up in that apartment? How did he get such a steal? Well, the answer would be, oh, because somebody in my family lived here first. And he told me, you know, so he didn't just leave and let the landlord give it to somebody. And technically what happened there was, so it wasn't that the buddy owned the apartment or that the cousin owned the apartment. He was a tenant. Obviously, the landlords don't like that happening. The landlord wants to be the one to give the favor out. And so what they had to do is the cousin didn't tell the landlord that he moved. The cousin was still making the payments, and my buddy was then paying the cousin the rent. And even they still had the mail delivered to the, you know, the cousin still had mail going to the old apartment, and then my buddy would just occasionally, you know, give him his mail, because they didn't want the mailman realizing that somebody else was living there now, because then, you know, they might get caught. Okay, so I'm just showing you, I mean, when you start intervening in these markets, all these crazy things start happening that most people don't think of. Okay, what else what other consequences occur? Well, there's lower product quality. Okay, so going back to the original slide there, when we were showing that there's an immediate shortage, and I said, oh, it's true, 9,000 people are still in the apartment building paying $650 a month, so arguably they're better off. And I said, but hold on, because things are going to change. Well, this is not what I'm talking about. That it's not even obvious that the people staying in the apartments are unambiguously better off with the rent control. Because, yes, they're paying a lower price, but the flip side is now the landlord doesn't have as much incentive to offer as good a product. And so, because, again, the landlord now has a long line of people who are dying to get into his building at $650 a month. So he doesn't have the incentive to keep all of his customers happy, because if somebody gets mad and moves out, what does he care? He could just fill that up, you know, the next day. So things like making sure all the light bulbs inside the building are replaced, you know, like in the hallways and stuff. If they're those fluorescent lights that just kind of gradually fade over time, the landlord's going to replace them a lot less frequently. As far as the paint starts chipping, the landlord's going to put up a new coat of paint less frequently. If a tenant calls at 2 o'clock in the morning and says, "Hey, the water heater's out. I want to take a shower because I work nights or something, and I want to take a shower before I go to work. You know, you got to get over here and fix this because the shower's ice cold." The landlord might say, "You kidding me? It's 2 o'clock in the morning. You know, I'll be over there at 9 and hang up," because customer service is not going to be high on his list of priorities. Since, again, just, you know, why would he do that? What's going to happen if somebody gets mad at him and leaves? He's got a whole line of people waiting to get in there. Okay, so that's the what you need to realize is that it will. Landlords, let me put it this way. Landlords aren't just going to take it sitting down that they can only charge $650. They're not going to continue to offer the same product that before they were getting $800 a month for, and now they're just going to say, "Oh, well, I guess I get $150 less." They will try to find ways to only to deliver a $650 a month product. All right, and that's actually, you know, this term slumlord, that comes from rent control. Okay, because what happens is, it's not so much that the rent control law automatically, magically turns somebody who is a very nice customer service oriented kind of guy into a jerk. What happens is, with the rent control threshold in place now, the original owners, they're going to get out of that business. They're going to sell the apartment building off to somebody else. Because it's $650 a month now, you need a different type of person running that business to make a profit. You got to have somebody who's ruthless, that if somebody misses, you know, is late on their rent, he kicks them out the next week to get somebody else in there. And, you know, because the only way you're going to make it work is if you always have the rents coming in, right? You can't afford to have a month vacancy because your margins are so tight now. And so that means if somebody falls behind, boom, you got to kick them out. Whereas before, at the $800 a month level, since the landlord may have been earning a higher, you know, margin on that, he could have afforded to be a little bit more lenient, right? Because if somebody fell behind, as long as they picked it up, you know, it was okay. But with your margin squeezed so much, you could never make it back. And so, you got to kick people out. And again, if people complain and say, "Hey, the radiator's not working, the hot water's out, my lights are messed up," whatever, he's going to be less likely to care about that. He's going to be ruthless. All right, and so that's this term slumlord. Again, we're not saying that mild-mannered people are magically turned into slumlords because of the government. What we're saying is people who have the personality type who could be a jerk landlord are able to run that industry in rent-controlled regions, right? Because their competitors, who would be more courteous and, you know, customer service and that sort of thing, but they would charge a higher price for it, they're not allowed to operate because of the rent control. Okay, we're running out of time here, so let's move on. Now the another a price floor is the flip side. So a price floor is where the government comes in and says, left to its own devices, the supply and demand curves in the free market would set a price that we think is too low. And so we're going to come along and insist that buyers pay a minimum price. So it's a floor, meaning so if it's falling and it hits the floor, it stops. So it can't go lower than the floor. And the one we'll use in particular is the minimum wage law. So here the government is saying, why don't we just go ahead and go to the next slide. So here the government's saying, in this hypothetical market, supply and demand for labor being what they are, and this is supply and demand for low-skilled labor, okay? Because it's not that every worker will get the same amount. We're like focusing on people with low skills, okay? And we're saying the supply and demand in this market would normally intersect at $5 an hour, and there'd be 100,000 people that would be hired. All right, and the government comes along and says, are you kidding me? You know, single moms can't support a family at $5 an hour. That's unconscionable. We're going to help the poor people. We're going to pass a law saying if we catch an employer paying someone less than $8 an hour, we're going to put massive fines on them. Okay, so now what happens? So if we assume that all the employers obey the law, and I should probably clarify, for this lecture, we're assuming everybody obeys the law. When we get to the drug prohibition section, we'll talk more about black markets and what happens when people evade the law. Here, talking about price ceilings and price floors, we're assuming, just for the sake of argument, that people are obeying the law, and we're just looking at the consequences of that. Okay, so here, if now all the employers obey the law and they pay $8 an hour, what happens? Well, again, immediately the next day, or whenever the labor contracts expire and people can renegotiate them, you get this unemployment. And that's a surplus of labor, because what happens is at the higher price, at $8 an hour, the quantity demanded of labor, so that if you start at the 8 and move to the right and you hit the D curve and you go down, that's only 80,000. So what that means is, what's the demand for labor? Well, that's coming from the employers. The employers are the one who buy labor services. So that's saying at the higher price, employers, instead of wanting to hire 100,000 people, only want to hire 80,000. But at that high price of $8, you keep following it to the right and you hit the S curve and drop down to, now it's 120,000. So that's saying the quantity supplied at $8 has risen to 120,000. So that gap of 40,000 is unemployment, right? So there are 40,000 people now, 40,000 low-skilled people who see that that people who are employed are making $8 an hour, and they say, heck yeah, I'd take a job for $8 an hour. And they go up to various employers and say, hey, can I work for you? And he says, sorry, we're all full. We're not hiring right now. Excuse me. Okay, so that's what unemployment is, when there are people who are trying to find a job and can't get one. And more specifically, they're trying to find a job at the prevailing rates. They see people who are making a certain amount of money doing a certain job. The unemployed person is perfectly capable of doing that job. The employer would agree, but the employer just says, I can't use both of you. This guy's already working for me, so I can't hire you. Sorry. Okay, so that's what unemployment is. Now, again, the analysis is similar to what we did with the rent control. Here, you say, okay, so in the short run, even on the face of it, it's not clear that the minimum wage law is helping the whole population of low-skilled workers. That yes, 80,000 of them just saw their wages go up by $3 an hour. So they presumably are happy about the change, or at least, you know, on that aspect of it, they're happy. A little bit later, we'll see reasons that they might not be as happy. But for sure, those 80,000 workers keep their jobs and they're making $8 an hour instead of $5. So you could say, okay, they're better off. But there's 20,000 workers who before would have been working at $5 an hour and now can't find a job at $8 an hour. So they're clearly hurt that, you know, let me put it this way. Before, when wages were $5 an hour, they could have just stayed home. Nobody was putting a gun to their head and making them get a job. They wanted to. They voluntarily went and worked at $5 an hour. So they thought working for $5 an hour was better than not working. And now the government comes along and pushes up the minimum wage to $8, and those 20,000 people can't get a job at all. So they're forced to not work. So they are clearly hurt that they would rather be working for a lower wage than be unemployed at a higher wage rate. So they're definitely hurt by it. And obviously the employers are hurt. They don't want the government coming along and making them pay more than they would have to for low-skilled laborers. Now, again, there's another 20,000 people who are among the ranks of the unemployed, but it's not correct to say that they're being hurt by the minimum wage law, except for the sense that they're, you know, if they waste their time filling out job applications and stuff, because if the government got rid of the minimum wage law and the wage fell back to 5, 20,000 of those unemployed people would just drop out of the labor force. You know, right, because the quantity supplied of labor would drop down by 20,000. So those 20,000 people would just stop trying to find work at the lower wage rate. So either way, that group of 20,000 people wouldn't be working. But there are a different group of 20,000 that would be working at $5 and now can't find a job at $8. Okay, another effect, and again, I'm sure you've noticed this, but just to make sure you see it, these points are all analogous to the points I made for rent control. So if you understood something in rent control, then just look at the analog down here and you can see how it plays out in the labor market for the minimum wage. So here, there's a lower long-run demand for labor. So again, as we did before, just switch back here. Immediately, once the government puts that minimum wage into place, there's a surplus or a glut of labor, which is what we call unemployment. So the supply and demand curves don't move immediately. We're just saying, given those supply and demand curves, now the government's forcing the price up, that's going to lead to this gap, this unemployment. We're saying now, additionally, there's going to be a lower long-run demand for labor. And the reason I put in the George Jetson thing here is I'm saying that what I mean is now if employers know that, oh, gee, now instead of paying $5 an hour, we have to pay $8 an hour, and we think that that's going to be in place for a long time, what are they going to do in the long run? Okay, so it's true. Immediately, they respond by cutting back how many workers they hire. Originally, they hired, 100,000? Now they only hire 80,000. So that's immediately what they do. But then over time, they're going to do other things. They're going to adjust to the new realities. So they're going to say, well, gee, if we're going to be forced to pay $8 an hour for workers, we want to have our facilities designed such that each worker can really give me $8 of productivity. And so they're going to, so things that before they might have hired a bunch of workers to do at $5 an hour, now they're going to have one person do that, but give him a lot of machinery or give him more tools so that he can do the job, and because you have to pay him $8 an hour. All right, so they're going to do more automation is what I'm getting at. And you can see an example of this. I've certainly noticed this just in my lifetime at fast food restaurants. Okay, it's incredible how they've streamlined those things. And so now that, you know, one person can have the headset on, can be taking orders from the drive-thru, can go ahead and do your order at the counter. And, you know, some of these places, like, they can just hit on the keyboard. They just have, like, the value meals there. So they just hit the certain combo of what it is. They can go and put the drink, you know, on the soda dispenser and just hit whatever size, you know, if you order the medium, they put the medium cup there and then just hit the button. And so the thing knows to only put in enough Coke that would fill up a medium cup. You know, and then the fries dispenser is that neat little funnel thing that they just pick up. And so the point is that's those things have happened over time, or when they give you change too, some of them, it'll shoot the coins out of a little thing on the side. right? So that the cashier doesn't have to waste time counting out quarters and nickels and dimes. That just shoots out on the side. Okay, so part of what all that is a way, you know, the owner of the restaurant is spending more money on machinery and other forms of automation so that they can shoot out more meals, right? They can serve more customers. They can sell more hamburgers and fries with a smaller workforce. Right? Now, some of that may have just happened naturally. I'm not saying that was all caused by the minimum wage, but what I am saying is the minimum wage exacerbated that trend, right? That it made it, you know, on the margin, if you're the employer and you could either hire a bunch of workers to do something or you can pay for machinery that needs fewer workers, well, if now the government comes along and arbitrarily makes workers more expensive, that's going to push you over to hiring or to going the route that has more mechanization. Okay, another example analogous to the non-price rationing of rent control is that there's non-wage competition. So here, the idea is that if you have various people competing for a job, you know, you're the employer, you have a slot to fill, and you got different people competing, well, people that might be at a disadvantage in other respects, like people with without a college degree or people who didn't go to a particularly good school or people who are, you know, in an ethnic minority or something, you know, they can compete by accepting a lower wage. And so, you know, you can say whatever you want to about that, but the point is that's one thing they can do in a market, and so they can at least get work. And so, that you know, that's, you know, people decry that. They look at the pay that goes to various groups, and they say stuff like, you know, women earn such and such for every dollar, you know, 90 cents on the dollar to what a man earns and that kind of thing. And we can go through those statistics and see that there's the reasons for that, you know, once you adjust for things like the danger of the occupation and that kind of stuff. But the point is, if you take that away, well, then that's actually going to hurt those groups, right? So if you're an employer, let's say that you you're thinking about, you know, you have a job, like some office job in your firm, and you're wife is nagging you that her brother needs a job because he's, you know, just out of school or something. So it's, you know, it's your brother-in-law, and you're thinking about giving him the job. Well, you know, you might not do that if somebody else is going to come along and be able to work for less, right? If you know that your brother-in-law is going to insist on being paid $8 an hour, just because, you know, he's like, that's what I want to do because, you know, otherwise he's going to play Xbox or something. And then this other immigrant fresh off the boat comes in and would be willing to work for $5 an hour because they need a job. Well, if the government comes along and says, no, you got to pay $8, well, you're more likely not to hire your brother-in-law. Okay, why wouldn't you? It makes your wife happy. You're paying the same amount and you know he can do the job. Okay, whereas before you might have been willing to take a chance on this new guy because he's cheaper. And you say, okay, yeah, I'll hire you and let's see how you do. And if you work out, okay, great. But see, now that guy can't get his foot in the door because the government has made it illegal for him to underbid the other people. Okay, and then the last point is lower workplace quality. So here, again, it's, you can't just assume that employers, well, let me put you this way. I think when people, like politicians or someone writing a letter to the editor or whatever, is in favor of, or if you listen to certain union members talk, people assume that employers have this huge pile of money that's just sitting there, and that raising the minimum wage, that all it will mean is now the super rich people will be just a little bit less super rich, And then they'll just hand out that money to all the poor people who are working, and that's it. When in reality, no, that the laws of economics still apply, the principles of economics still apply, and employers now, if before, you know, you were paying $5 an hour, and now you have to pay $8 an hour, you're going to look for ways to cut costs elsewhere. You're going to cut back on things that before you had done to attract employees. Okay, because it's true that the salary or the wage is a very important component of a job, but that's not the whole description. There's all sorts of attributes going into what makes for a pleasant work experience or, you know, a job that you like. It's not just how much are they paying me. And so the, you know, example I used in the textbook was you could imagine, you know, and I gave the numbers to show you that it's possible people working in a factory, they could either have fans in there that, you know, they'd still be sweating and still be pretty hot, or they could have an air conditioning unit installed, but the air conditioning would be more expensive than the fans would be. But the workers might say to the employer, we'd be willing to take a pay cut for you to install the air conditioning. So in other words, the workers would their paycheck would be smaller, but they would much prefer to live in or to work in this nice air-conditioned environment. But depending on the numbers, it might be illegal for that to happen. The employer could say, no, legally, I have to pay you this amount in your paycheck, and so now I don't have enough left over. It's not worth it to me to install the air conditioning. Okay, and again, if people are miserable, what does the employer care? Because with the minimum wage law, there's this huge surplus of labor. There's a line of people who want those jobs at $8 an hour. So if somebody's not happy, employer says, okay, leave. I don't care. I got a whole line of people out here willing to come in. Okay, so little things like that, you know, having a nice break room that has machines installed with, you know, candy and pretzels and stuff like that, and having a TV that works in the break room, and having it, the tables, you know, getting washed and stuff, and having the bathroom having nice toilet paper and stuff like that. I mean, just little things like that that you might take for granted that an employer can decide to spend more or less money on to make their employees happy. Or, you know, more serious things like having pension plans and having health benefits and stuff like that, or having a parking lot. You know, maybe the employees are complaining because the parking lot's uncovered, and so on rainy days they get soaked coming into the building. And so the employer would consider, you know, building a canopy or something, or, you know, to cover from when they go from the parking garage across the street into the building. Maybe the employer would think about putting some sort of canopy over there to protect them from the rain. And maybe the employer would have done that when the wages were $5 an hour, because then that would have been a very competitive labor market, and the employer would know, if my employees are unhappy and they leave, it's going to be hard for me to find replacements for them at $5 an hour. So I want to keep these employees happy, so maybe I'll go ahead and spend the money to put the canopy in. But at $8 an hour, he's not going to do that. He doesn't care if the employees are happy or not. So what if they leave? He's got tons of people waiting to come in and replace them. Okay, so that's the kind of thing you need to think through. So even the people that keep their jobs now may not, they're not as better off as they initially might think. So right when people love their jobs at $5 an hour, now the government comes along, boosts the pay to $8 an hour, and yeah, 20,000 people lose their jobs, but the other 80,000 that keep their jobs, they're thinking, oh, this is great. I have the same job, and I'm making $3 an hour more, but over time they might realize, wait a minute, this isn't the same job. You know, when the TV goes on the fritz in the break room now, they don't replace it. You know, the TV burned out. They didn't put a new TV in there. They just said, well, you guys don't need a TV. You're at work. And, you know, now they're charging us for parking. And so if we don't want to pay for parking, now we got to park way down the street and walk 3 blocks to work, whereas before we didn't have to do that. Okay, so yeah, they're making more, but their employer now is looking for ways to cut costs, things that the employer used to do for the benefit of the employees, now the employer's not doing. Okay, so I'll stop there, and since we started late, I will... Danny, are you still logged in here? Are we okay on time, or is somebody coming in after us that we got to get out of here? Not sure if Danny's still with us. Okay, well, let me look at your, see if you guys have any questions for me. Okay, we have time. So, yeah, why don't we go, we'll do 10 minutes of questions, because I know you guys may have stuff you got to do. So we'll go to 45 after, in case you guys had questions. So let me pull up the Moodle website. Oops, sorry, I'm in the wrong class. Okay, week 7. Okay, Andrew says, what is the Austrian school's opinion on the outsourcing of low-skills manufacturing jobs to developing countries? I understand the arguments presented regarding comparative advantage and the benefits of lower production costs, hence lower price. Yet realistically, there is a mismatch in the skills required in the growth industry, for example, technology or financial services or banking, compared to the skills these workers can offer. Okay, and then he elaborates. Let me just answer that. Well, I've written a lot on this. If you go to my Mises.org archives, it would have been a few years ago. I was getting into debates with Paul Craig Roberts on this. So the short answer to your question is, as far as economic efficiency goes, I think outsourcing is, there's nothing wrong with it. Now, I should clarify, I don't necessarily speak for all Austrians on that. I think you would find some self-identified Austrians who might be not so sure that outsourcing is the same type of thing as just having free trade in products. But I think most of them agreed with my side of the argument when I was arguing with Paul Craig Roberts on that. So the basic... Let me do this. This is the way I did it. It was a little thought experiment. I don't know if this is going to convince you or not, but suppose we have some a medical diagnosis outsourcing, right? So you go in, and normally the hospital would have to have a bunch of U.S. doctors. So if you're an American and you go into a clinic, and there'd be a doctor there with his staff, and they would look at you and see, you know, what your problem was and say, oh, okay, you've got strep throat, and so here we're going to write a prescription and give it to you. And that would be, and so now that's coming under fire because you've got the ability now with the internet and everything. You can go into a clinic and, you know, they can put machines on you and look at you and whatever, but then there's not actually an MD at the clinic, a medical doctor. There's people in India who are trained medical doctors, and we send all your information over to them, and then they look over it, and then they say, oh, the person has strep throat, and what you should prescribe these antibiotics, blah, 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 and they send it over. Okay, so that what's happening is the demand, even not just for low-skilled work, but even for high-skilled labor is being outsourced. Or, you know, the classic example that people in the U.S. are familiar with is, you know, call service. That if you call up a credit card company or you call up the phone company or whatever, you press the menu and you get connected, and then the person talking to you clearly has an Indian accent. That happens a lot. And you realize that they actually might not even be in the U.S. They might be over in India. Okay, so the way I sort of analyzed that is I said, well, suppose... instead of it happening that way, suppose instead that some firm in India invented this new computer gadget and they exported it to the United States, and so we imported it in the U.S. And what the gadget does is you just talk into it and you say what your symptoms are, and then it tells you, oh, you have strep throat. Okay, or if you have a question about how come my BlackBerry isn't working, I can't get online, you can talk to the computer and the computer tells you the answer. Okay, so that's a little bit, I realize that's contrived, but if that were to happen, then clearly that would fall under the standard analysis of free trade. And yes, it's true, importing this clever device from India that could diagnose medical issues and could tell you how to fix your BlackBerry and, you know, could handle customer service questions, that would put out of work a lot of U.S.-based doctors and U.S. people who originally were answering phones, but it would also shower benefits on U.S. consumers, right? It would be the same analysis as if we imported cars from Japan. And yeah, that would put out of work U.S. automakers, but it would be good for U.S. consumers. So it's the same analysis in that respect. So again, if you understand why free trade is good on that in terms of goods and services, well, goods, crossing borders, then it's not that hard to see that conceptually that's the same argument would show why the ability to outsource is good. Now, having said all that, it's not obvious that we would see this huge wave of outsourcing in the absence of government intervention, right? Because a lot of it is because of stuff like minimum wage laws and occupational safety stuff where the employers have to install all sorts of things, other sorts of regulations that U.S.-based employers have to comply with that foreign firms don't have to. And so to the extent that you think some of those rules are silly and wouldn't happen in a free market, well, then you can say those are extra, you know, extra hurdles that the U.S. government is putting on U.S. employers. And so to that extent, you know, outsourcing is not just a pure market outcome. It's partly the result of interventions by the U.S. government. Okay, this will be the last question. Stephen Davis says, can you talk a bit about supply and demand curves in the short run versus the long run? Instead, before I leave that topic, Andrew, I will try to go dig up the Mises.org articles and post them in the forum here so you can go read those, because I give pretty lengthy answers and I try to address all the particular concerns about outsourcing. So I have more to say on the topic than what I just gave you right now. It's just we don't have time to get into it. Okay, so back to Stephen's question. Can you talk a bit about supply and demand curves in the short run versus the long run? Sure. So the way we're using them in this lecture, and just in general, when you draw a supply and demand curve, you have to have some time frame in mind, right? Because that's what it means. You're saying at this price, how many units would people buy? And so you need to, you know, what do you mean? How many would they buy this minute? How many would they buy this hour? How many would they buy this week? You see? So it, by definition, supply and demand curves only make sense if you have some sort of time frame in mind. So the way when we were developing it in the chapter on supply and demand, we were saying I think it was a Tuesday afternoon. So there we had a few hours in mind as to what time period we had for when these numbers were going to be applicable. So what I mean when I was going through and showing you, here's a supply and demand curve for apartments, and then I was showing you in the short run there's this shortage, and then in the long run, you know, the supply curve moves. What I meant there is that if you're having the original scheme be something like, you know, a week or a month or maybe even a year, you would see one set of impacts. Whereas if you're looking over at a longer period of time, you would see a different impact, right? So that in the short run, it's the supply curve itself isn't going to move very much. So if I guess what I'm saying is if the supply curve refers to something like a week or 2 weeks, you're not going to see that curve itself move right after the introduction of a minimum wage law. But if your supply curve is showing over a 10-year span what's going on, then, you know, it's the curve itself is going to move because of the rent control. Or rather, if you have the curve saying, you know, how many apartments are going to be rented per month, and then we say, let's look at that curve 10 years from now, that's going to shift. Okay, so I misspoke. That's the idea. So the curve itself, we're always assuming, is like based up monthly, let's say, for the apartments, because that's kind of a normal unit. You're saying how many people this month are going to rent the apartment. So if we're just looking at it this month, that curve's not going to move. But now if I say, let 5 years go by, then the monthly supply curve is going to shift to the left. Well, because of, you know, people making decisions about how many new apartment units to build and whether to allow existing ones to be maintained and that sort of thing. Okay, well, we're out of time. So thank you, everyone, for your flexibility. And thank you for bearing with me as I got in here a few minutes late because of the traffic jam. And I will, as always, be answering.